Elefante, the shy Brooklyn bachelor who dreamed of escaping Brooklyn to move to a farm in New Hampshire and marry a fat country girl, and even had the looks and charm to find one, but was too kind to drag any woman into his life of brutality and stealth, which had made his mother a prison widow and half-mad eccentric, a life that had diced his father's kindness into bits. Perhaps they saw neither. Perhaps they saw only the outer shell, the silent, cold, brutal elephant, whose calculating calm and mum stare said, "You are finished," and who dispatched them with the matter-of-fact speed and brutality of a Category 5 hurricane, ripping everything apart as he went. The elephant's stare reduced the hardest men to terror. He'd seen the fright explode across their faces when his silent business face emerged. And try as he could not wipe those expressions of fright from his own memory, the most recent being the colored kid Mark Bumpus and his two hooligans at the abandoned factory on Vitale Pier 3 years ago, when he'd caught them red-handed trying to steal $14,000 from him.
"I'll help you," Bumpus had pleaded. "I'll help you fix things," he wailed.
But it was too late. Peck found himself staring at Elefante's silence at that moment, a silence so palpable that to Joe, it was almost like hearing it and seeing it at the same time. For Peck had experienced it several times when they were teenagers, and his own inner alarm sounded off as loud as the blaring of a ship's bullhorn. Peck realized he'd gone too far. His angry facial features twisted into blinking alarm as Elefante's blank stare combed his face, the interior of the car, and Joe's hands, which, they both noted, remained on the steering wheel, where they should be, Joe noted ruefully, and had better stay.
"Don't come at me like that again, Joe. Find somebody else."
Elefante withdrew from the GTO and stood with his hands at his sides as Joe threw the GTO in gear and roared off. Then he placed his hands in his pockets and stood in the middle of the street alone, giving the silent, roaring rage inside him time to ease down and out. And after several long minutes, he once again became who he was, a solitary, middle-aged man in the August of life, looking for a few more Aprils. An aging bachelor in a floppy suit, standing on a tired, worn Brooklyn street in the shadow of a giant housing project built by a Jewish reformer named Robert Moses, who forgot he was a reformer, building projects like this all over, which destroyed neighborhoods, chasing out the working Italians, Irish, and Jews, gutting all the pretty things from them, displacing them with Negroes and Spanish and other desperate souls clamoring to climb into the attic of New York life, hoping that the bedroom and kitchen below would open up so they could drop in and at minimum join the club that to them included this man, an overweight bachelor in an ill-fitting suit, watching a shiny car roaring away. The car driven by a handsome young man who was pretty and drove away as if he were barreling into a bright future, while the dowdy, heavyset man watched him jealously, believing the man so pretty and handsome had places to go and women to meet and things to do, and the older, heavyset man standing behind, eating his fumes on a sorry, dreary, crowded old Brooklyn street of storefronts and tired brownstones, had nothing left but the fumes of the pretty sports car in his face. A dreamless, friendless, futureless, sorry-ass New York guy. Elefante watched the GTO turn the corner. He sighed and headed back to his Lincoln. He slowly slid his key into the lock, entered the car, and sat behind the steering wheel in silence, staring. He sat in the soft leather of the car for several long moments. Finally, he spoke aloud. "I wish," he said softly, "somebody would love me." Chapter 12. Mojo. Sportcoat sat on a crate inside Sausage's boiler room, clasping a bottle of King Kong. He was in no hurry now. The disappointment of chasing the bottle of brandy around the plaza before it was destroyed by soup that morning was softened by this pit stop at Sausage's headquarters. Sausage was nowhere to be found, and that was fine. Sportcoat had spent the rest of morning there, cooling his heels with some Kong. He felt better now, evened out. "No hurry," he thought happily, clasping the bottle. He thought he might get up to look at the clock to check the time, but by the tilt of sunlight in the tiny basement window, he got the general idea. Afternoon. He stretched and yawned. He was supposed to be at work at the old lady's garden on Silver Street at least 2 hours ago. He tried for a moment to remember her name, but couldn't. It didn't matter. It was Italian and ended with an I, and she paid cash. That's what was important. She didn't mind too much if he was late. He always stayed late if he arrived late. But she had seemed a bit unsteady on her feet in the past few weeks. Getting old, he thought, wryly. You got to be strong to get old. He was about to put the Kong away and head out when Hetty suddenly appeared. "If you're going to come at me hankin' about what happened at Soup's party today, don't bother," he said. She chortled bitterly. "I don't care what you done," she said. "Fact is, when you walk about being spit on, it don't much matter what else you think you done."
"Who spit on me? Nobody spit on me."
"You spit on yourself."
"Get gone with that foolishness. I'm going to work."
"Well, get on then."
"If it pleases me to stop for a bracer while I ruminates on getting my baseball game going again, that's my business."
"That game don't mean nothing to these children around here," she said soberly.
"How would you know? You didn't see a game I umped in 10 years.
"You didn't invite me in 10 years, she said. That stumped him. Like most things he did most of his adult life, he couldn't remember exactly what happened, largely because he was drunk at the time, so he said, "I was the best umpire the Cars house has ever seen. I give joy to everyone. Except your own wife."
"Oh, hush."
"I was lonely in my marriage," she said.
"Stop complaining, woman. Food on the table. Roof over our heads. What else you want? Where's the damn church money, by the way? I'm in a heap of trouble on account of it."
He lifted the Kong to his lips and gulped down a long swallow. She watched him silently, then after a moment said, "Some of it's not your fault."
"Sure ain't. You the one who hid that money."
"I ain't talking about that," she said, almost pensively. "I'm talking about the old days when you was a child. Everything ever said to you or done to you back then was at the expense of your own dignity. You never complained. I loved that about you."
"Oh, woman, leave my people out of it. They're long dead."
She watched him thoughtfully. "And now here you are," she said sadly. "An old man, funning around a ball field, making folks laugh. Even the boys don't follow you no more."
"They'll follow me plenty when I get him back on the field. But I gotta get off the hook about them Christmas club chips first. You kept the money in a little green box. I remember that."
"Where's the box?"
The church got plenty money.
You mean the box in the church?
No, honey. It's in God's hands. In the palm of his hand, actually.
Where's it at, woman?
You ought to trade your ears in for some bananas, she said, irritated now.
Stop talking in circles, damn it. Pastor declares the church got $3,000 in claims for that money. We got liars falling out of the trees now. There's more folks at Five Ends on Sunday mornings hankering about that money than you'd see in a month of Easter Sundays. Every one of them's got eyes for that box.
Diggs Weatherspoon says he got $400 in there, and that fool ain't had two nickels to rub together since Methuselah got married. What am I do about that?
She sighed. When you love somebody, their words ought to be important enough for you to listen.
Stop lumping on about nothing.
I'm telling you what you want to hear, fool.
Then she was gone.
He sat in a huff for several minutes. There was no money in the church. He and Hot Sausage had searched the small building a dozen times. He felt thirsty and turned the bottle of Kong, only to discover it was dry. But there were other Joy Juice hiding places in that basement. He rose, dropped to one knee, and ran his hand under a nearby cupboard, finding it bare. Then heard over his shoulder the sound of the door opening and saw the back of Hot Sausage's head as Sausage walked in and strode out of sight behind a large generator on the other side of the room. He said,
"Sausage?"
There was no answer. He could hear Sausage grunt and the clattering of tools being moved around. So he said,
"You ain't got to hide from me. There was three bottles of Kong down here to my recollection."
As if in answer, there was a sparking sound and the huge generator fired up with a roar, the sound filling the room. Sportcoat rose and shuffled around to the side of the generator to find Hot Sausage nearly prone on the floor, stretched out with his head inside the motor of the same model of ancient roaring electric generator that befuddled Rufus in the watch house's boiler room. Sausage stretched out on his hips sideways, offered a quick sullen glance, then turned his attention back to the generator, which sputtered unhappily. Sportcoat grabbed a crate and slid next to him. Sausage had removed his pork pie hat. His blue Housing Authority uniform was ragged and grease-stained. He glanced at Sportcoat again, then back to the roaring engine. He didn't say a word. Sportcoat yelled over the din.
"I'm sorry, Sausage. I'll go to the police myself to straighten it out. I'll explain it all and ask him to tell me how long I have to leave town."
Sausage, peering into the roaring engine, chuckled.
"You a doggone fool. I didn't mean in no way, shape, or form to get you mixed up in no nonsense, Sausage."
Sausage lightened and pulled a long hand out of the machine to shake. Instead of shaking it, Sportcoat stared at the hand, frowning.
"I done apologized. So why the left hand? You know that's bad luck."
"Oh, sorry." Hot Sausage hurriedly pulled his right hand out of the generator and extended it. Satisfied, Sportcoat shook it and sat on a nearby crate.
"Where's the Kong?"
he shouted over the din. Sausage reached under a nearby tool bench and produced a quart-sized glass jug full of clear fluid, carefully sliding it over to Sportcoat. Then he turned his attention back to the generator, peering inside.
"This thing quits every week," he said. "Rufus got the same problem over at the watch houses," Sportcoat yelled. "These projects was built the same year. Same apartments, toilets, generators, everything. Bad junk, these generators. But I takes care of my generators. Rufus says it ain't the generators. It's bad spirits."
Sausage sucked his teeth, made a few adjustments, and the machine's decibel level lowered to a bearable volume.
It ain't no damn spirits. Rats? Ants, maybe?
Not this time of year. Even ants ain't stupid enough to climb inside this thing. Its cockeyed wiring is what it is. Old as Methuselah. Been fiddled with a lot, too. Whoever done it was pulling his privates with one hand and fiddling at the wires with the other.
Sportcoat sipped from the whiskey jug again and held it out to Sausage, who took a generous gulp, handed it back to Sportcoat, then peered back into the guts of the old machine.
"Dumbest thing in the world," he said. "There's 32 units in this building. This thing runs electric to only 4 of them. It's wired to the other one over there."
He nodded toward a second large generator on the wall on the far side of the room, separated from the first by a sea of junk that cluttered the basement. Old sinks, bricks, brooms, refuse, pieces of bicycles, mops, toilet parts, and Sausage's old wooden pendulum clock.
"Whoever built this place was drunk, I reckon, to set them apart that way instead of making them just one."
Sausage sipped again, placed the bottle on the floor next to the generator, stuck his long hands into the machine, and tied two wires together. The generator sputtered, coughed a moment, then chugged onward.
"I gotta replace the church's Christmas club money somehow, Sausage."
"That's the least of your problems."
"Oh, cut that nonsense. This is real money here we're talking. Hetty never told me how much was in that Christmas box, or where she hid it, or who put what in. Now Pastor G says there's $3,000 in claims on it. Everybody and their brothers swearing they got money in it."
"That don't include the $1,400 I throwed in," Sausage said.
"Very funny."
"No wonder you're seeing Hetty's ghost, sport. I'd be chicken-hearted, too, with that kind of money floating north of me."
"You got trouble all around.
You did lock that door behind you coming in, didn't you? Deems ain't got nothing against me. But outside of a child in pain, the worst sound in the world is an old man begging for his life while he's at work. What's to stop him from coming in here blasting?"
"Stop fussing about nothing," Sportcoat said. "Ain't nobody following me, and I ain't talking to Hetty's ghost. It's a nag that's bothering me, Sausage. What I'm talking to is a nag. A nag ain't a ghost. It's a mojo, a witch, playing tricks. It looks like a person, but it ain't. It's just a witch. The old folks talked about that back home all the time. A witch can take any form she wants. That's why I know it ain't my dear Hetty talking. She never talked that way, calling me an idiot and carrying on. That's a witch."
Sausage chuckled.
"That's why I never got married. My Uncle Gus married a girl like that. He met a girl down in Tuscaloosa and got into a hank with her daddy. One of his cows ate some of her daddy's corn. Her daddy wanted 40 cents for that corn. Uncle Gus didn't pay it. His wife hollered at him, but he wouldn't. And then she died and put a wangature on him. Baddest mojo I ever seen. His chest bone growed out like a chicken's breast. The hair on the sides of his head smoothed out. The top of his hair stayed kinky. That was a weird-looking nigger. He looked like a rooster till he died."
"Why didn't he just pay her daddy back?" Sportcoat said.
"Too late then," Hot Sausage said. 40 cents ain't gonna stop no mojo. 400 cents would stop it, once it gets going. His wife put a nag on him, see? Like Hetty done to you."
"How you know Hetty done it?"
"It don't matter who done it. You got to break it. Uncle Gus broke his by taking a churchyard snail and soaking it in vinegar for 7 days. You could try that. That's the Alabama way of breaking mojos, sport coach said. That's old. In South Carolina, you put a fork under your pillow and some buckets of water around your kitchen. That'll drive any witch off.
Nah, Sausage said. Roll a hound's tooth in cornmeal and wear it about your neck.
Nah, walk up a hill with your hands behind your head.
Stick your hand in a jar of maple syrup.
Sprinkle seed corn and butter bean holes outside the door.
Step backward over a pole 10 times.
Swallow 3 pebbles.
They were off like that for several minutes, each topping the other with his list of ways to keep witches out. Talking mojo as the modern life of the world's greatest metropolis bustled about them. Brooklyn traffic roared above ground. In Borough Hall, 20 blocks away, the Brooklyn Borough president was welcoming Neil Armstrong, the first man to walk on the moon. In Flushing, Queens, the New York Mets, the former dogs of baseball and now the toast of the town, were warming up for a game at Shea Stadium under TV lights with 56,000 people in the stands. On Manhattan's Upper West Side, Bella Abzug, the flamboyant Jewish congresswoman, was meeting with fundraisers to consider a run for president. Meanwhile, the two old men sitting in the basement sipping moonshine were having a mojo contest.
Never turn your head to the side while a horse is passing. Drop a dead mouse on a red rag.
Give your sweetheart an umbrella on a Thursday.
Blow on a mirror and walk it around a tree 10 times.
They had reached the remedy of putting a gas lamp in every window of every second house on the 4th Thursday of every month when the generator, as if on its own, roared up wildly, sputtered miserably, coughed, and died. The basement went nearly dark, the lights dimming low, and they would have gone almost completely black but for the second generator, which sputtered onward, powering a single bulb in a far corner of the basement. It shone brightly, as did the exit light over the hallway door through which Sport Coat had entered and which he had tightly closed upon entering.
Now you've done it, Sausage grumbled in the near dark. Coming down here carrying on about witches and all, you put a spell on the damn thing.
He knelt, groped inside the generator, and made a few adjustments. The generator coughed miserably, sputtered, and grumbled back up. The lights in the room came up full again. Sport Coat glared at the generator, puzzled. It seemed louder than ever, roaring at a speed that was unusual, powering along with a shake rattle so loud that Hot Sausage had to shout over it at the top of his lungs.
I think it's got a short,
he shouted over the roar. Sport Coat nodded.
But if it's connected to 4 apartments upstairs, he yelled, why is the lights going out down here?
What?
Forget it, he yelled. I got to get to work. Where's my umpire uniform?
What?
Sport Coat pointed to the roaring generator. Sausage knelt and adjusted the machine, and the roar kicked back a decibel. From his crouch, he repeated,
what?
I'm getting the baseball game going again, Sport Coat said. I need my umpire uniform, remember? I know it's down here someplace.
What you need that for? We ain't got no pitching.
Our star pitcher ain't got no ear, and he's gunning for you.
Sport Coat, irritated again, took another sip of King Kong.
Just get it.
It's right where you put it last, Sausage said,
taking the bottle and nodding at a closet in a far corner. Sport Coat gazed at the pile of refuse that stood between them and the closet. He looked down at his plaid sport coat.
I'm gonna mess up my jacket digging through that.
Sausage sucked his teeth, handed the bottle to Sport Coat, and disappeared into the cacophony of junk. After several clangs, grunts, kicks, and shoves, he reappeared moments later with a black plastic bag, which he tossed on the floor. At that moment, the generator emitted a horrible burst, coughed, sputtered, sparked, and died again. A moment later, the second generator quit as well. The room went completely dark this time, save the exit sign over the door. The door, which neither noticed, now stood slightly ajar.
"God damn," Sausage said in the silence. "This one here must have shorted out the other one. Give me a flashlight, sport."
"That ain't something I normally carries about, Sausage."
"Stay here. I'ma check the generator on the other side."
There was more clattering as Sausage scrambled to the other side of the room. Sport Coat sipped his Kong nonchalantly, felt for the crate with his feet, found it, and sat down. Neither of them noticed the tall figure in the leather jacket who had slipped into the room through the door underneath the exit sign.
"Do this happen all the time?" Sport Coat said in the silence. "Never like this," Sausage said from across the room. "'Course, when you calling on witches and so forth."
Sport Coat heard him curse and grunt, then heard a noise near the door and glanced at it. In the light of the exit sign, he saw, or thought he saw, a shadow move past it.
"Sausage, I think there's somebody—"
"I got it,"
Sausage called.
"Okay, there's a switch box behind that generator where you're at. Go back behind it and throw it when I tell you. That'll bring the lights up."
"Throw what?"
"The switch behind the generator where you're standing. Feel around that generator and throw that switch there,"
Hot Sausage said.
"That'll fire them both."
"I don't know nothing about no switches."
"Hurry up, sport. There's 32 apartments upstairs. Them Negroes is cooking collards and scrambled eggs and gotta get to work. Ain't nothing to it, sport. Just go round back of the generator. Stick your hand behind it and feel a thick wire coming out. Follow that wire to the wall with your hand. You'll feel a box there. Open that box and throw the switch in there backward and forward one time."
"If it's all the same to you, I'd rather cook what little brains I got left with whiskey,"
Sport Coat called out.
"I can't see nothing. Plus there's somebody—"
"Get up and do it before them fools upstairs come down here raising hell."
"I don't know nothing about no boxes."
"You can't get electrocuted back there,"
Sausage snapped, trying not to sound impatient.
"It's all grounded. That generator there's 240 volts. This one here's 220.
He paused, then said,
"Or is it the other way around?"
"Make up your mind now."
"Just go throw that dang switch in the box, please. You got nothing to worry about, sport. This is the circuit breaker here. The juice is here. It ain't over there where you at."
"If it's over there, why don't you throw the switch over there?"
"Stop being lightheaded, nigga. Hurry up before the Negroes upstairs get here hollering. Or even worse, call up housing."
"All right,"
Sport Coat said, irritated. He groped his way through the dark, found the generator, ran his hand along the wall behind it until his fingers found a thick wire. He groped the wire, following it to the wall, turned to address Sausage, and saw again the shadow of a man cross the exit light and move toward the middle of the room. This time, he was sure of it.
"Sausage,
throw the switch.
There's somebody—"
"Will you throw it already?"
"All right. What about this wire?"
"Forget the wire now. You don't need it. Throw the switch."
"I don't need this wire? This loose one?"
There was a long silence from Sausage.
"Did I forget to tie that thing off?"
he muttered.
"Tie off what?"
"The wire."
"There's two.
Wires or boxes?"
"Both."
Well, don't worry about that, Sausage called, more impatient now. Just find a box, any box. Throw the switch in any box you touch and make sure the wire don't touch the generator. I'm holding the panel to this generator box open. I can't hold it much longer, sport. It's heavy. There's a spring on it. But the wire, forget the wire. It's all grounded, I tell you. What's grounded mean? Nigga, you want math and a marching band too? Just throw the goddamn switch. I'll fix everything when we get the lights going. Hurry up before the whole building riots on us down here. Sportcoat chose the box nearer to him. He opened it and felt inside. There were two switches in it. Not knowing what to do, he placed the bare wire on the generator and threw both switches. There was a flickering spark, a grunt, and the squealing howl of a human. As the roar of the generator fired and the lights came back up, he caught sight of two boots flying upward in the air. From the other side of the room, Sausage angrily approached, clattering over the piles of benches, cinder blocks, sinks, and bicycle parts, jawing as he came. What's the matter with you, sport? How hard can it be to throw a switch? Then he stopped, silent, and stared wide-eyed at something in the middle of the floor. From his side of the room, Sportcoat clambered over the junk, and the two of them stood over Earl, Bunch's trigger man. He lay on his back, out cold, his black leather jacket scorched from where the electricity had coursed through him. A shiny watch protruded from his wrist, its crystal broken, and a revolver was squeezed tight in his hand. Good God, Sausage said. That's the fella from Soup's party. How'd he get back so fast? I thought they carried his ass off. Sportcoat stared at him. Is he dead? Hot Sausage knelt, feeling Earl's neck for a pulse. He's yet living, he said. He'd have been ramped up good if they let him drink that brandy, rather than letting Soup waste it by busting it on his head. You want to call the police?
Hell no, sport. Housing'll blame me.
You ain't done nothing wrong.
Don't matter. However the cut comes or goes, if the police show up at housing, it means they got to write a report. That means they got to do something down there other than take naps and sip coffee. Anyone who disturbs them from doing that gets walking papers. I'll be out of my job. He looked down at Earl. He got to go, sport. Let's put him out.
I ain't touching him.
What you think he come here for? To teach you letters? He crawling around here with a pistol. He's somebody Deems put on you.
Deems is a boy, Hot Sausage. This here's a man. Plus, little Deems ain't got no money to hire nobody to do nothing.
Little Deems got a Firebird car.
He do? Glory. That boy's running a big mill, ain't he?
God damn it, sport. I'll take my baseball bat and send you hooting and hollering out that damn door. You brung trouble to my job. Now he got to go, and you got to help.
All right. You ain't got to get all tied up in a knot about it.
But Sausage was already moving. He yanked the four-wheeled dolly from the junk pile in the middle of the floor, wheeled it over to Earl, then, kneeling over him, checked his pulse again.
I've been shocked by that generator before. It's gonna take him a while to come to himself, but he'll be all right. In the meantime, let the devil have him.
They set to work. 20 minutes later, Earl woke up in the alley behind Building 17. He was lying on his back. His burned leather jacket smelled like scorched hair. His arms ached so bad, he was afraid he'd broken both. His head knotted with a lump from where the bottle had knocked him cold, felt as if a jackhammer were banging away at it. He raised his right arm, a movement that sent pain roaring down his shoulder, and checked his watch. The crystal was broken. The watch was dead. He moved his left arm, found it alive, and pulled his gun out his left pocket. He noted the bullets had been emptied from it. He shoved it back into his pocket and sat up. His feet were wet, so were his legs. He'd wet himself. He looked up at the sky and the windows above him. He saw no faces peering at him, but could tell by the sun's position in the sky that it was afternoon. He was late. He was supposed to collect yesterday's take from Bunch's Bed-Stuy street dealers by noon. He got to his feet slowly, every muscle in his body protesting, and staggered toward the nearby Silver Street subway, leaning on the wall as he went. He felt like he was falling to pieces, but moved faster as he got his wind, keeping one eye out for the giant who had escorted him there that morning. He had to make it to Bed-Stuy to pick up Bunch's cash before heading back to the boss's house. The least he could do was show up with Bunch's rocks. It might keep the boss from killing him. Chapter 13. The Country Girl. Elefante and the governor sat in the living room of the governor's modest two-family brick house in the Morris Heights section of the Bronx, a calm enclave of apartment buildings dotted with a few leafy trees amid coming urban decay, when the door burst open and a mop swept into the room, followed by an attractive woman pulling a wheeled bucket full of soapy water. Her head was down, and she mopped at the floor with such speed and intensity that at first she didn't notice the two men sitting in the room. Elefante was in the rocking chair with his back to the door. The old man was on the couch. The woman swept from left to right and then hit the leg of the rocking chair and saw a foot. She looked up in surprise at Elefante. Her face flushed a deep red, and at that moment, Elefante saw his future. She was a heavy-set woman, getting on in years, but with a sweet face that could not bridle the shyness that emanated from it, with wide brown eyes that, at the moment, blinked in surprise. Her brown hair was pulled back to a bun, and a long, cute, dimpled chin lived beneath a pleasant mouth. Though heavy, she had the frame of a tall, thin woman. Her neck was long, and she hung her head a bit, as if to de-emphasize her height. She wore a green dress, and her feet were bare.
"Oops, I was just coming in to clean."
She backed out of the room, quickly, and slammed the door. Elefante heard her footsteps retreating to the back of the apartment.
"Sorry," the governor said. "That's my lass, Melissa. She lives downstairs."
Elefante nodded. He had not seen Melissa long, but he had seen her long enough. It was the barefoot part, Elefante thought later, that did it. The no shoes. What a beauty. A country beauty. The type he'd always dreamed about. He liked heavy women, and she was deeply shy. He saw that immediately. It was the way she moved, with slight clumsiness. Her head down, that long neck swinging that pretty face away from what was happening. In that moment, he felt an inside part of his tightly wound heart loosen, and understood with certainty the governor's problem. He doubted that shy beauty had the guile to run a bagel shop, much less take care of whatever business the governor had with this piece that he wanted to dump for dollars, whatever it was. That type ought to be running a country store someplace, he thought dreamily, running it with me. He shook the thought as he saw the governor watching him, a slight smile on his lined face. They had spent the afternoon together. The old man had been cordial. He'd greeted Elefante like they were old friends. The bagel shop was just two blocks away, and despite the governor's wheezing and poor health, he insisted they walk over. He proudly showed Elefante the entire operation, the large eating area, the display cases, the store crowded with customers. He showed him the back garage area where he kept his two delivery trucks, and finally, the kitchen, which he saved for last, where the two Puerto Rican cooks were finishing up. "We start at 2 a.m., the governor explained. "By 4:30, the bagels are hot and rolling out the door. By 9, we've moved 800 bagels. Sometimes we move a couple thousand a day," he said proudly. "Not just for us. We sell to shops all over the Bronx." Elefante was impressed. It wasn't so much a bagel shop as it was a factory. But now the two men were back in the governor's two-family house, in the upper apartment where he stayed, and with the pretty daughter apparently safely down in her apartment below, he was eager for the real talk. One look at the daughter told Elefante all he needed to know. If the governor was telling the truth, he had no real plan.
"It's not my business," Elefante said.
"But does your daughter know anything about what I'm here to discuss?"
"Christ, no."
"Don't you have a son-in-law?"
The governor shrugged. "I can't tell you the ways of the young. In the old days, Irish legend had it that the seals on the beach in Ireland were really dashing young princes who slipped out of their skin to become seals and marry the merry mermaids. I think she's looking for a seal."
Elefante said nothing. The governor suddenly appeared tired, and he leaned back into the couch, his head tilted up toward the ceiling.
"I've no son. She's my heir, that one. She'd give it the full shilling if I told her about this business, but she'd make her bags of it. I want her out of it."
He seemed, by nature, a light-hearted man, but the tone of that statement let Elefante know that the door was open to his taking full charge of the affair and negotiating a better price for himself, if there was indeed anything to the old man's story at all. The man was exhausted. That small bit of walking to his shop and the tour of it had worn him out completely.
"I'm a bit jaded, and might have to rest my head on me couch in a while," he said. "But I can still talk. We can get started now."
"Good. 'Cause I'm not sure what you're selling."
"You'll know now."
"Talk then. It's your party. I already asked around. My papa had some friends who remember you."
"My mother says my papa trusted you,
and that you two did talk. So I know you're okay.
But you have a good operation here. This isn't a bagel shop. It's a factory. It's clean. It makes money. Why get flashy and monkey with trouble when you're making good guineas now? How much dough do you need?"
The governor smiled, then coughed again and grabbed a handkerchief and spat in it. The glob he spat into that handkerchief, Elefante saw, was big enough that the governor had to fold the handkerchief in half to use it again. This Irish paisan, he thought, is sicker than he's letting on. Instead of answering the question, the old man tilted his head back again and said,
"I got this place and the bagel shop in 47. Well, my wife got the shop, actually. I was in jail that year with your father. Here's how we got it. I had some money put up. How I got that money doesn't matter. But it was a good amount of chips. I made the mistake of telling my wife where it was while I was in prison. She came to visit one day and said, 'Guess what? Remember the old Jewish couple on the Grand Concourse with the bagel shop? They sold it to me cheap. They wanted out fast. She said she couldn't reach me to make a decision. She just went for it. Bought the whole fecking building. With my stash.'"
He smiled at the memory.
"She told me about it in the visitor's room. I ate her head off. I blew my top so bad the prison guards had to call me to keep me from wringing her neck. It was weeks before she even wrote to me. What could I do? I was in a slammer. She burned up every penny we had on bagels. I was shook. Mad as a box of frogs."
He stared at the ceiling, his face wistful.
"Your father thought that was funny. He said, 'Is it losing money?' I said, 'How the hell would I know? There's niggers and spicks all over.' He said, 'They eat bagels too. Write to your wife and tell her you're sorry.' I did. Blessed God. And she forgave me. And now I thank her every day
for boy in that place. Or would. If she was here.
When did she pass away?
Oh, it's been... Oh, I don't keep track.
He sighed, then sang softly. 20 years of growing. 20 years in blossom. 20 years of stooping. 20 years declining.
Elefante found himself softening, the inside part of him, the part that he never let the world see, the part that had loosened when the man's daughter swept her mop into the room.
Does that mean you have a clear conscience on the whole bit, or just a bad memory?
The governor stared at the ceiling a bit longer. His eyes seemed fixed on something far distant.
She lived long enough to see me come out of prison. She and my Melissa. They built the business while I was in jail. 3 years after I came out, my wife took ill. And now, I'm a little under the weather myself.
A little under the weather? Elefante thought. He looked ready to keel over.
Luckily, Melissa's ready to take it over, the governor said. She's a good lass. She can fly the business. I'm lucky she's so good.
All the more reason to keep her out of trouble.
That's where you come in, Cecil.
The elephant nodded, uncomfortable. The reference took him by surprise. He hadn't been called that in years. Cecil was a childhood nickname his father had given him. His real name was Tommaso, or Thomas. He bore his father's name as a middle name. Cecil was his father's creation. Where it came from and why his father chose it, he never knew. It was more than a name of adoration. It was a sign between father and son that they needed to talk privately. His papa was bedridden in his last year, still running the business, and there were often other people about his bedroom, men who worked in the boxcar, in construction, and in the storage house. When Papa said Cecil, there was important business, private business about, and they needed to discuss it when the room cleared. The governor's knowledge of the name was a further sign of credibility, and also, Elefante thought glumly, responsibility. He didn't want to be responsible for this guy. He had enough responsibility. The governor eyed him a long moment, then gave in to his fatigue. He shifted and pulled his legs on the couch and lay down, stretching out, an arm on his forehead. He raised his other arm and pointed a finger to a desk behind Elefante.
Hand me a pen and paper from that desk, would you? They're right on top.
Elefante did as he was told. The governor scratched something on the paper, folded it tightly, and handed the paper to Elefante.
Don't open it yet, he said.
You want I should stuff ballot boxes for you too?
The old man smiled.
That's not a bad thing to know, considering what happens to old codgers like me in our game. You get tired, you know. Your father understood that.
Tell me about my papa, Elefante said. What do you like to talk about?
You're trying to trick me, the Irishman said with a low chuckle. Your father played checkers and said 6 words a day. But if he said 6 words, 5 of them, what about you?
He didn't show me that side much, Elefante said. After he came back from prison, he'd already had the stroke, so talking was hard. He was in bed a lot. He was about survival in those days. Keeping the boxcar busy, working for the fam... He paused. Working for our customers.
The governor nodded.
I've never worked for the 5 families, he said.
Why not?
A true Irishman knows the world will one day break your heart.
What's that mean?
Oh, I like breathing, son. Most people I knew who worked for the families ended up getting dragged across the quit line in pieces. Your father was one of the few who died in bed.
He never trusted them completely, Elefante said.
Why?
Lots of reasons. We're Northern Italian. They're Southern Italian. I was young and stupid. He didn't think I'd live long when I got made.
He kept me busy running the dock. He gave orders. I followed him. That's how it was. Before he went to jail.
And after.
He was the puppet master. I was the puppet. Worked the boxcar, move the stuff, ship it here, there, store this guy, pay that guy, pay your men well, say nothing. That was the gig. But he always kept a foot in other things. Construction, a little loan business, even a gardening business for a while. We always had other interests.
You had other interests because your father did not trust.
He did trust. He was just careful about the people he trusted.
Because
a man who doesn't trust cannot be trusted. The governor smiled.
That's why you're the right lad for the job.
He looked so satisfied, Elefante blurted, If you feel a song coming on, don't bother. I had Cousin Brucey on the radio in the car all the way over. He played Frankie Valli. Nobody sings better than him. The old man chuckled, then raised a frail hand and pointed at the piece of paper in Elefante's closed fist.
Read it.
Elefante unfolded the paper and read, A man who does not trust cannot be trusted.
I knew your father well, the governor said gravely, as good as I knew any man in this world.
Elefante didn't know what to say.
Now, I am going to sing,
the governor said brightly, and it's going to be better than Frankie Valli. And he proceeded to talk. As Elefante drove his Lincoln down to Major Deegan heading home that evening, the note still folded in his shirt pocket. His mind was spinning. He thought not of the story the governor told him, but of the country-looking farm girl who'd come into the room and backed out the door, apologizing, excusing herself. A shy, pretty Irish girl. Fresh as spring. She was a little younger than him, 35 or so, he guessed, which was old not to be married. She seemed so shy. He wondered how someone so meek could run a business. Then again, he thought, I've never seen her in action. Maybe she's like me, he thought. All show business at work, gruff and bitter, but at home, at night, crowing to the stars for love and company. Or maybe I'm a moron, he thought bitterly, just an aching heart in a city full of them. Jeez. He gunned onto a ramp that exited to the FDR Drive, then zipped down the east side of Manhattan toward the Brooklyn Bridge. He was glad to be driving. It allowed his mind to roam and the confusion to quell. It was just past 4:30 p.m., and traffic was still moving smoothly. He turned on the radio, and the music jarred him back to reality. He scanned the East River, checking the line of barges moving along. Some of them he knew. A few were run by honest captains who refused hot items. They wouldn't move a stolen tire if you paid them $1,000. Others were captained by blithering idiots who would kick their scruples out the window for the price of a cup of coffee. The first type were honest to a fault. They just couldn't help it. The second type were born crooks. Which one am I? He wondered. Am I good or bad? He thought as he maneuvered the Lincoln through traffic. He thought about getting out of the game altogether. It was an old dream. He had plenty saved up. He'd made enough to live. That's what Papa wanted, right? He could sell his two rental houses in Bensonhurst, sell the boxcar to Ray out in Coney Island, and step out once and for all. To do what? Work in a bagel shop? He couldn't believe the thought entered his mind. The governor's daughter didn't even know who he was, and he was already putting himself in her kitchen. He pictured himself 10 years from now, a fat husband in a cook's outfit, slinging dough and slamming it into an oven at 3 a.m. On the other hand, what was life all about? Family. Love. That woman was concerned about her father. She was loyal to family. He understood that feeling. It said a lot about her. He talked to her briefly before he left. The governor had fallen asleep on his couch after their conversation, and Elefante went to the door to let himself out. She was coming up the stairs to check on her father and caught him. He'd guessed she heard him leaving and wanted to make sure her father was okay. That's what he would have done. Check that her father was breathing. Maybe make sure the stranger wasn't some Goomba from years past who showed up wanting to even things. That said a lot about her, too. She was shy, but clearly not that shy, and not stupid, and not afraid. They'd met in the hallway by the front door. They'd talked maybe 20 minutes. She was immediately open and candid. He was someone her father trusted, so she trusted him. "I can handle things," she said, when he asked her about running the bagel shop on her own. He had joked about her tearing into the room mop first, holding the bucket and using the mop as a spear. She laughed and said, "Oh, that. My papa cleans like a kindergartner."
"Well, he's worked hard enough."
"Yes, but he leaves his place a mess, and he falls asleep so easily."
"My feet fall asleep when I'm running for the bus."
She laughed again and opened up more, and in the ensuing chat showed that behind the gentle veneer lay qualities more like those of her father. Light-hearted, funny, but with the firmness and cleverness he found alluring. They chatted easily together. She knew he was there for important business. She knew their fathers had been close friends, yet he still sensed a tentativeness. He probed her gently. That was his job, he thought bitterly, as a goddamn smuggler working with low-life drug dealers like Joe Peck and murderers like Vic Gorvino, to sense weakness in others. Standing there, he felt her probing him as well. He felt her size him up and squeeze him, gently, for information. Try as he might, he couldn't block it, couldn't prevent her from seeing the part that most never saw. That while he was firm and tight on the surface, all business, maybe a little too Italian in his manner and speech, beneath it he bore the heavy sense of responsibility for his mother and those he cared about with kindness that was safer to hide. He was the man her father trusted. But why him? Why not a cousin, or an uncle, or at least a fellow Irishman? Why an Italian? In those 20 minutes, the war between the races, the Italians versus the Irish, was waged. The two representatives of the black souls of Europe, left in the dust by the English, the French, the Germans, and later in America by the big boys in Manhattan, the Jews, who forgot they were Jews, the Irish, who forgot they were Irish, the Anglos, who forgot they were human, who got together to make money in their big power meetings about the future, paving over the nobodies in the Bronx and Brooklyn by building highways that gutted their neighborhoods, leaving them to suffer at the hands of whoever came along, the big boys who forgot the war and the pogroms and the lives of the people who survived World War I and World War II, sacrificing blood and guts for their America, so they could work with the banks and the city and state to slap expressways in the middle of thriving neighborhoods and send the powerless suckers who believed in the American dream scrambling to the suburbs because they, the big boys, wanted a bigger percentage. He felt it, or thought he felt it, as they stood by the front door. There was a connection, a man whose father was dead, and a woman whose father was about to die. A sense of wanting to belong, standing in the warm vestibule, she in her farm girl dress, with a job that paid taxes and drew no cops, no Joe Pecks, no complicated phone calls from complicated people trying to pick your pocket with one hand while saluting the flag with the other. And he feeling a sense of belonging he hadn't felt in years. She laughed easily, asking questions, the shyness gone now, while he nodded silently. She talked the entire 20 minutes, which seemed to pass in seconds, and all the while he felt like shouting, "I'm the seal on the beach, if you only knew me." But instead, he was light and firm, half-heartedly trying to block her questions by pretending to be aloof and distrustful. She saw through it all, he could tell. She saw him clearly. He felt naked. She wanted to know why he was there. She wanted to know everything. But she could never know. That was part of the arrangement. He had agreed to the governor's harebrained scheme, of course, in part because he loved his father. The parts of his father that he knew ran deepest were all about trust. Any man his father trusted had to be a loving, good man. There was no doubt. Guido Elefante had never backed out on his word with a man he trusted. Neither did his father care what others thought of him. Papa loved his mother. No doubt because Mama was anything but the typical Brooklyn Italian housewife like so many on his block, the women who chatted about nothing, tossing cannolis around, filing obediently into Mass at St. Andrew's every morning, praying for their husband's redemption and, by extension, their own, complaining about the niggers and the spics taking over the neighborhood while their husbands ran liquor and shot anyone who opened their mouth wrong about their gambling operations and horse racing fixes and their running roughshod over the coloreds. His mother didn't care about the coloreds. She saw them just as people. She cared about plants and digging for them in the empty lots around their neighborhood. Plants, she insisted, that had kept her husband alive long after most expected him to be gone. And as for their son, she never asked questions of Thomas. She respected Elefante when he was but a boy because she understood instinctively that her son would be different from most of the Italians in the neighborhood. Had to be different, just like she and her husband had to be different to survive. She never made apologies for her family. The Elefantes were what they were. That was all there was to it. Papa had welcomed the governor into his world. And so, Elefante did as well. They were partners now. That was decided. Also, there was the intrigue of the whole business. And, of course, the money. Was it about the money? He asked himself. He glanced at the folded paper on the car seat next to him. It was the paper that the governor had placed in his fist when they spoke of Papa. A man who does not trust cannot be trusted. Elefante swung the big Lincoln to the off-ramp of the FDR just past Houston Street. The silhouette of the Brooklyn Bridge loomed ahead. He thought of their conversation again and the governor's story.
"I'm losing my mind," he murmured.
It had been late afternoon, and the governor was nearly asleep when he told Elefante the story of the soap he'd given to the younger man's father. Lying on the couch, he spoke to the ceiling while a fan overhead creaked ceaselessly. "For almost 1,000 years, the Church of the Visitation in Vienna, Austria, had these precious treasures," he said. "Manuscripts, candle holders, altar cups. Most of it would be biscuits to bear to you and me. Stuff used during Mass. Altar cup to drink our Savior's blood. Candle holders, that sort of thing. Some gold coins. All of it was made to last. It's hundreds of years old, this stuff. Passed down through generations. When World War II came, the church hid it from the Allies.
That's where my younger brother, Macy, was stationed.
He was sent there in 45 during the war. America kept troops there after the war, and Macy stayed on. Macy was 8 years younger than me. A lieutenant in the army, an odd fellow. He was, the governor thought a moment. "A ponce," he said.
"A ponce?" Elefante repeated.
"Light as a feather. They'd call him a sissy today, I guess. He had a taste for the finer things in life, always liked art. Even when he was little, he knew all about it. He read books on art. Just had a taste for it. Well, the city was all torn up after the war.
patrolled by different armies here and there. And somehow, Macy found this stash of stuff. It had been hidden by the Nazis in a cave near a place called Altenburg.
The governor paused, thoughtful.
How Macy found that cave, I never knew. But there was valuable stuff in there. A lot of it. Helped himself to it. Manuscripts, tiny little boxes decorated with diamonds, with little panels of ivory, and some reliquaries.
What's that?
I had to look it up 5 times before I understood it, the governor said. They're tiny boxes like coffins, made of gold and silver. Some are trimmed with diamonds. The priests kept jewelry, art, relics, even old bones of saints in them. This stuff was heavy loot, the spoils of war, my lad. Macy got hold of a good gob of it.
How do you know?
I saw it. He had them in his house.
How'd he get all of it home? The governor smiled.
He used his noodle and shipped it to himself by the U.S. Military Postal Service, little by little. I guess that's why he stayed in the service so long. The stuff was small. Then, after the war, he got a job at the post office so he could move it when he wanted without nobody making a stink. Simple as that. He chuckled and had to raise himself as he coughed a large amount of phlegm into his handkerchief. When he was done, he folded the handkerchief, put it back into his pocket, and continued.
It always seemed odd to me that Macy lived too well to work at the post office,
the governor admitted.
He had an apartment in the village the size of a rugby field, full of fancy things.
I never asked.
He had no kids, so I figured it wasn't anything. My papa couldn't stand Macy. He used to say, Macy likes boys.
I told papa,
there was a priest at St. Andrew's who said to like boys.
But he didn't want to hear it.
I was a young man back then, fast on my feet and a bit of a wanker. But even then, I knew the difference between a sick man who likes children and a man sweet on men. I knew because Macy talked me out of killing that half-langered rail Bulgarian priest at St. Andrew's who acted the maggot with a lot of kids in the parish. I found out about him when Macy grew up, and we started adding up crib notes on him. But Macy said, he's a sick man. Don't go to jail for him. He was my kid brother and he was smarter than me in a lot of ways. So I listened and went to jail on my own. Even in prison, Macy's smarts helped me.
If you walk into the slammer not looking for a hop-on, knowing that what a man does in his private time is his own damn business so long as he doesn't make things worse for you, well, you're all right. So I loved Macy for what he showed me, and he trusted me.
The governor sighed and rubbed his head as he plowed through the memory.
He didn't live long after the war. First our mother died. Then a couple of years later, cancer got him. That and a broken heart, poor lad, because his father didn't want him. Toward the end of his life, he came to me and confessed everything. He took me to a closet in his house and showed me what he had. He kept all those things from the cave in a closet. Imagine that. Wonderful things. Bibles with solid gold covers, relics, manuscripts rolled into tubes made of gold. Gold coins, diamond reliquaries with bones of old saints inside. He said, this stuff is 1,000 years old.
I said, you're a millionaire.
He said, I hardly sold any of it.
I made a good living at the postal service.
I laughed at him. I said, you're a stock.
A stock?
Elefante repeated.
A fool.
Oh.
He said, I didn't want to sell them. I just liked looking at them. I said, Macy, it's not good. These are things from the church. The church doesn't care for people like me, he said. Oh, it broke my heart when he said that. I said, Macy, my boy, our dear mother in heaven would fall to fever at God's throne, knowing you sit here with stolen things from her Lord and Savior. It would break her heart. That brought a tear to his eye. He said, I have to live. Maybe I'll find a way to return a few things.
The governor looked at Elefante.
And return them he did. Oh, he sold one or two more things in droves to keep his lifestyle before he died, but most of the things he returned. He got them back to Vienna the same way he got them there. He mailed them back, little by little. He returned them in a way so he could never get caught.